welcome. You're tuned in to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tim Dennis will join me a little later. We've got dumb crimes and stupid criminals, and I think we're going to share some of your I Knew a Murderer stories. For those of you that are new to the podcast and the show, if you know a murderer and you've been in contact with one, and it's alarming just how many people actually know a murderer, somebody that was part of their lives, or if you're a survivor of a serial killer attack, we'd love to hear from you. You can email your stories to me at dave@darknessradio.com. That's dave@darknessradio.com. And remember, for all of the guests you hear on our show, if you're interested in their books, you're interested in the projects they're doing, go to darknessradio.com and click on the Killer Deals link. It'll take you into our Amazon page where we've hand-selected all of the different books from the guests that we've had highlighted on the show. So it's the easiest, fastest reference point for you to find all of the information from all the different guests that we cover on both the Paranormal Show and on our True Crime program. So let's get started. It's great to have our guest join us again today. We've had him on a few times. Crime writer, serial killer expert, and New York Times best-selling investigative journalist M. William Phelps is here with us. He's got a brand new book called Targeted: A Deputy, Her Love Affairs, and a Brutal Murder. It's great to have you back on. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Dave, thanks for having me on, man. Call me Matthew.
Oh, all right. Will do, Matthew. Now, let me, you know, one of the things I found fascinating, and I guess I didn't even really realize this up front, you were kind of a consultant for the first season of Dexter. Is that right?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. I get asked about that a lot. It actually was, I consulted on the show before, before it even started. So, the first season is right. And what I did was, first of all, I created a bunch of marketing for them. I created a contest for them. A pretty elaborate contest. They staged a scene in back of a bunch of semi trucks in a glass box in all the big cities, so Times Square, L.A., Chicago, Miami, and it was a contest to kind of promote the show. So I created that contest. I created most of the stuff on the website having to do with that contest, and I consulted on some crime scenes for them. So it was exciting. It was a hectic couple of days there doing that.
Let me ask your advice, or not advice, but opinion on this aspect of this. I know Dexter came out, and it really was a fantastic show. It was really well done. I loved it. I held off on seeing it, I think, the first five seasons. I just couldn't wrap my head around the idea of a serial killer hero. So I avoided it, and then once I got wrapped into it, man, I couldn't stop watching it. It was such a well-done, well-crafted show. But as somebody who is an investigative journalist, sees into the dark underbelly of our society and real crimes, real serial killers, and somebody who has spoken to real serial killers, did you have any conflict in helping to promote a show that essentially made a very dark, disturbing character kind of a hero in a way, and made Dexter this kind of lovable, acceptable, brutal murderer?
I mean, that's a fair question, and it's a really good question. I didn't because, I mean, if it was a nonfiction show, if it was a docuseries, then right, I'd have a huge conflict. But the fact that it was a drama and it was fiction, etc., you know, I kind of got it, and I kind of looked at it as something that was actually unique for television. It was actually a unique premise, a unique storyline. What got me was later on. I mean, the show got really out of control the last couple of seasons, you know, Dexter falling in love with another serial killer. And, you know, it just got out of hand.
That happens though, Matthew, right? I mean, that's the weird thing. I was with you on that. I was like, come on, another serial killer. And then I just started remembering how many killers were couples or friends. And that's really kind of a more chilling and disturbing aspect of murderers to me, is the fact that it's one thing to realize there are just some broken people in society and you're going to run into them on occasion. But then to realize that they're finding each other, and you can say to your beloved, you know, this person's got to die. Yeah, let's get rid of them. and it's okay. Their red flags aren't going up and they join you. That is kind of a very compelling dark side of that. When I realized what they were doing, and I started doing some research at that time of how many couples were like this. Starkweather, of course, jumping to mind. You had your Bonnie and Clydes, and you've got all these characters throughout history that are real characters that were bloodthirsty killers that were friends or lovers. That's a really weird aspect of serial killers as well, right? Because we've always kind of been led to believe that they're one-offs, they're lone wolves that do this. But there's more and more coming out about how some of them are actually working in tandem with one another.
I mean, that's an anomaly, really. That's a lightning strike. It's not the norm. When we talk serial killers, we talk about there's thousands of serial killers, perhaps, in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, there's been thousands. And the norm isn't anything like we see on TV or in Hollywood.
Right.
So when something like that does happen, like you described, it really sticks out to us. So we really notice it. I can see why they took the drama that way. I mean, I totally get that. But for me, it just got really, it felt like a jump the shark moment. You know, it felt like they were kind of extending it a little bit too long. And I mean, I really like the premise of a serial killer being a cop, being a crime scene guy. I mean, that to me sounds like it could happen. I've really never seen it happen, but it sounds like something that could happen. You see, we saw it with Firestarter, Joseph Wamba's book in L.A. about the arsonist who was actually an arson investigator, and he was the main culprit who was starting all those forest fires back in, I think, the 70s and 80s. So that's an interesting premise for me to look at something from. But, yeah, I mean, going back to your original question, I mean, Dexter was kind of is it okay to kill bad people? I guess that's the question, right?
Right.
Is it okay to kill bad people? And can you humanize a guy? That's one of the only things that I think they got really wrong in it, but they needed it for the show, was that a serial killer, a psychopath can't feel love. They don't love. There's not love in them. So for him to love the kids and love that, that's not the way he did on the show, is that that's not reality. They cannot do that. It's impossible. It's just not in their DNA to do that. So,
but they can wear that mask, right? Which we've seen in a lot of cases.
The mask of sanity.
Right.
Yes.
You had Ted Bundy, who was a sociopath serial killer who was in a committed relationship with a woman and her daughter, you know, at the time that he was arrested. And you've got a lot of these cases where it's like that. They put on that costume. The costume is Ted Bundy, not the monster that he really was. The costume was
BTK.
John Wayne Gacy.
Right.
Right. BTK, same thing. You've got a lot of that. And BTK felt very much like the John Lithgow character in the Dexter series to me. Right. That kind religious guy, the leader, you know, but then has this just unbelievable immoral side. I thought what I thought was interesting in the show, and what, like I said, I kind of held off on it for a while because having been a victim of a murder, you know, and I shouldn't say a victim, but a survivor of my first girlfriend in high school was brutally murdered by her ex-boyfriend, and two of her children were killed as well. So that's really kind of kept me involved in trying to understand this. So I stayed away from the show, but when I watched it, I thought it was interesting to see that they looked at the nature versus nurture side of it. And once Dexter's father realized what Dexter was, he showed him how to hone it. So if you're going to do this, I know I can't stop what you're doing, and I know I can't stop the darkness, but at least let's focus it. And you've investigated a lot of killers and spoken to them. They do seem to have some OCD to them, that they have kind of a pathway that they do. They're ritualistic in a lot of the things that they carry and the way that they do it on nights that they commit their murders. So to me, that almost makes sense, that what if we could take a serial killer who we know we can't fix, but we bent them in the direction we wanted them to go. So that's what I thought was an interesting takeaway from the show, was it was kind of the nature nurture. He was born into this kind of bloodthirst and this horrific deal because of what he witnessed. And then it was twisted off. Do you find in any of the work that you've seen or research that you've done on killers, has there been any of the parents who've eventually come forward and said, well, we always knew there was some darkness there and we tried to channel it a different way? Or do they all just seem completely dumbfounded that their kid was capable of doing these things?
No, I mean, most, if you go back and you talk to family members,
mm-hmm.
Most will say, oh, yeah, there was something wrong with this person. We didn't foresee this person growing up to be a serial killer, of course, but definitely something was off with this person. And I talk about this in my book, Dangerous Ground, where I interview, you know, Happy Face for the 5 years. And I go into depth about this. And I did, Dr. Adrian Raine in the UK has done a tremendous amount of research in this area where a psychopath is born.
Mm-hmm.
So you're born a psychopath. You just don't have that empathy cells gene in your head, if you will. And brain scans prove this. So, okay, does that make you a serial killer? Hell no. No, absolutely not. But if you begin to, going back to your Dexter, you begin to witness things in your immediate environment as a child and later as a teen, et cetera, this all now begins to fire up the wires inside you to become somebody because you already have the foundation in you of being a psychopath, right? So now you're just being nurtured into being this killer part of it where maybe some other people are nurtured into becoming this person on Wall Street who ends up taking the life savings of a million people, right? And just does not care, right? So there's a lot of wires that need to be fired up inside the head for someone to end up killing multiple people over a period of years, you know? And it's I don't know if fascinating is a word, but it's something we need to really, really look at. And I should go back to saying, which was your original premise, that one of the reasons Raine is doing all this research is to find out, geez, if we can scan the brains of kids when they're born and we see this and we know this, wow, maybe we can steer them in the right direction as they grow up instead of letting society, you know, steer them in the wrong direction.
Right, because we don't know what the catalyst is. We don't know
right.
where that one turn is, and it's, you know, talking about pop culture, and I reference this on occasion, it's funny, but it fits, is, you know, you look at the very popular character Batman. He witnessed a tragedy that sent his life in one direction. You've got the Joker who says, hey, we're all one bad day away from being me. And you right. wonder just how close that is. How close to reality is that? That it really doesn't seem to take people. And we've been doing this thing on our show for a number of years where we have people send in the stories. Because at first I was like, man, there are so many killers out there. So many serial killers that are going. And we started getting phone calls from listeners. We had a phone call from someone who had escaped Gacy and a woman who had escaped Ted Bundy. And you start realizing, we're like, wow, really? This is it. And Matthew, the amount of emails we got was disturbing. And then Tim and I kind of talking about, we're like, how could this even be possible? And then we realized both of us know two murderers in our own personal circles as well that were put away and are now dead. That's chilling to realize there is not very many degrees of separation from any one of us to a real murderer.
Well, that's discussed in Dangerous Ground. I mean, Jesperson, Happy Face, says to me in the book, you know, he says, anybody can become a murderer. And I push back on that. That's not true. That is not true. And we got to be careful because here's the reality of it when you look at the numbers. The numbers are that crime rates in this country, violent crime, rape, assault, murder, have dropped drastically over the past 23, 24 years in half, 100%.
Really?
They have dropped in half. There is half the amount of murder and assault and rape in this country today as there was 25 years ago. That's across the board on paper. While at the same time, the reporting of those murders left over has gone up probably 1,000%. So we're seeing it all the time. It just doesn't mean there's more of it.
Okay, so we've declined by at least half over the last 23 years, but have the type of crimes that have continued, have they become more brutal? Is that what, you know, I mean, it was a few shootings every couple of years, you'd hear these mass shootings. Now it seems we're dealing in this country with 2 to 3 mass shootings per year. Was that always part of it?
That's a different, Yeah. I mean, but that's a different thing. When we talk mass shootings, that's mental illness across the board. Mm-hmm. I'm a firm believer in that. That's a whole different discussion, you know, for me. But no, you are definitely right. The brutality of the murders has definitely increased. And look, what came into the picture over the past 20 years? The internet, right?
Right.
So that has something to do with it. We're seeing whatever we want to see now. Whether I'm 13 years old or I'm 30 years old or 80 years old, I can see whatever I want to see within seconds. I can have it in front of me, whatever it is, right? So the brutality, and look, for the most part, I'm a female murder expert. I mean, I write about female murderers. I talk about female murders on television every week. I mean, that's my gig, basically. And so I study that mind a lot. And let me tell you, females over the past 10 years have amped up the brutality of the murder tenfold. Females used to kill very, very nonchalantly, if you will, back in the day. I mean, you know, fire, poison, that was common. Now, you know, you're seeing a lot more stabbings. You're seeing a lot more bludgeoned to death, that sort of thing. It's more brutal. It's more violent. I believe it's more of a sign of how people are feeling inside, pent up frustration, volcanic rage, that sort of thing. It's all there. Coming out.
You mentioned the internet, the rise of the internet over the last 20 years and how the brutality is increasing. Do you believe that it's because we're being basted in it on a regular basis, or do you believe that we are becoming a more broken structure where we used to have more of a familiarity to people, and now we're so engrossed in our social media and our internet that people aren't talking, they're not communicating the same way, and then when they are communicating, most of us, half the day is spent seeing hate and anger and disgust, and is that the catalyst that's starting to connect those wires you talked about earlier? Which, you know, I mean, do you think it's both in play or one or the other a little bit more?
I think that has something to do with it, but I firmly believe the main reason for it is that there's so little value today placed on human life. We don't place the same amount of value on human life as we did 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 25 years ago. People don't care as much anymore as they used to. And, you know, that we could argue why that is all day long. We could debate that, talk about that, dialogue about that. But there's definitely less value placed on human life. I mean, people are killing now over, people have always killed and murdered for, you know, nothing. But the amount of it now is just wow. It's just off the charts, really.
Do you know if there are any, you know, are there any studies that have been done, aside from the internet being definitely an interesting catalyst point for this? I'm also wondering, as we're watching kids today, which is what I'm sure my parents said and their parents before them said, right? The kids seem to become more and more aggressive earlier and earlier on. And when you start to look, so many of our foods are being pumped with steroids so they can get more yield from the beef, from the chicken, from the pork. They're pumping these things through with steroids. Then we're ingesting this, which is becoming part of us. Do you think that a lot of these people are in a way kind of dealing with a connected roid rage, and that might be part of what's going on? Do you know if there's any studies or connections that have been made to that at all?
Boy, I'd love to see that. If there is, I'd love to see it, because, yeah, I mean, you know, take it one step further. Why is everybody now gluten intolerant now all of a sudden?
Right.
Well, what changed? What changed is we chemically started modifying wheat so it would be more resistant to disease, and so it would grow more, and so people would make more money, right? So it wasn't natural anymore, right? It was modified. It was scientifically modified. So yeah, there's definitely pieces of the puzzle there that are missing that we need to figure out. But it's just the amount of brutality in society is just wow. It's just off the charts today. I see it every day, you know, in my work.
Let's start to get into the book. It's targeted: A Deputy, Her Love Affairs, and a Brutal Murder. And as you said, you focus on women that are murderers, and kind of in this case, first of all, can you tell me, why did that attract you to your field of investigation? Why female murderers specifically?
Oh, that's an answer. I mean, that's something I talk about all the time in my lectures and stuff, is that the female murderer is far more interesting to write about than the male murderer. And it's more of the fact that at least the females that I write about, murder is more psychological. There's more behind it to the female than there is to the male. To simplify it, the primal instinct of a male is that a male can snap and, we were talking about this earlier, can kill at any time, protecting his family, et cetera, whatever. Whereas the female, really, really, it's really intimate. It's psychological to the female, where she thinks about it longer. She plans more. It could be more emotional. It could be more sexual. It could be all these things. So there's a lot more to it, psychologically speaking, which me as a researcher, as a writer, I like to explore. It gives me more terrain to explore in a book.
Can I ask you, I'll just be very blunt in this kind of question. Does it make it easier to talk to women murderers? You're a good looking guy. You're not imposing in that sense, but to men, you might be more of a threat. Do you believe that because of who you are, the way you look, the way you present yourself, that you will get more information from a female murderer than you would perhaps from talking to men?
No, they're much, much more difficult to speak to than the males. The males are more willing and open to answering just about any question.
Is that because of the ego, you think? With the men, they want to kind of brag about what they've done?
Well, no, they're just much more frank. It's more black and white. There's no gray area. With the females, when you interview female murderers, female psychopaths, there's always this gray area where you don't know what the hell she's thinking and where she's coming from. And if she's telling you not only the truth, but if she's not just gone off on some tangent now where, oh my God, where have we gone? So it's much more difficult. There's a lot more layers to look, to be honest with you, men are much more simple. And I'm not saying that women are difficult or anything. I'm not saying, I'm just saying that men are much more simple when it comes to this stuff that I do. It's pretty cut and dry. It's like I'm not answering that question. Whereas if I ask the same question to a female, she'll talk her way out of answering it. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
instead of just saying, no, you're not getting that out of me.
What drew you to this case that you cover in Targeted?
Wow. What drew me to this case was a couple of things. A, it was a deputy sheriff who was behind bars for the murder. So that's odd that you don't see that often, that a cop is behind bars for a murder. That's very rare. The other thing that really stuck out to me that I wanted to explore in great depth was the victim's mother. The victim's name is Doug Benton, and his mother, Carol Benton, believes that Tracy Fortson, the killer, is innocent. So the victim's mother in this case believes that the person who killed her son is innocent. And I really wanted to just dig into that and see where, because that is very rare.
Yeah, it is.
I've never heard that before. So I wanted to explore that because that meant something to me. If the mother of the victim thinks the killer is innocent and has been framed, then I got to look at it,
Right. Yeah, that definitely says something when one of the most protective people, in this case, the parent, the surviving parent of the murder victim, is actually taking the side of the reported murderer. That certainly opens up a whole new aspect. All right. Talk to me about Tracy Fortson before this all went down. What was she like growing up and through her life? Was she a positive person? Was she good? Did she have a strong family life? What can you tell me about her?
She had a very positive family life. I mean, she had a very good childhood, if you will. She told me some stories, and there are stories in the book about, some aggressiveness and at home with dad and that sort of thing. And her and dad had a volatile relationship. Her mother had a volatile relationship with dad, but nothing that, I haven't seen before in people who grew up normal, to be normal people. This story takes place in Georgia. I mean, it was rural, you know, farming country. Tracy grew up riding horses, riding motorbikes, doing tomboy stuff. Tracy, you know, at one time was a big chick. She power lifted weights, you know, she was tough, you know, rode a Harley, that sort of thing. So for the most part, I mean, she had a pretty normal childhood, bumps and bruises, but normal childhood. She did, though, one thing I did outline in this book, which I have to look at whenever I look into something like this, when a woman kills her boyfriend, she did have some very different types of relationships, which the subtitle is affairs, love affairs, growing up. When she was young, she dated a much older married man. You know, I think she was 18 or 17, and he was, I don't know, in his late 20s, married, kids, dated him for a while. You know, she had some rough relationships. Relationships didn't always go her way, that's for sure.
But other than that, she didn't stand out from anybody else, really, that you'd ever come into contact with on a normal day. She wasn't violent. She wasn't a fire starter or a bedwetter. None of the nonsense we've been brought up to believe because of TV. She didn't fit any specific pigeonhole then.
Absolutely not. I mean, she, from kind of an early age, she had a family member in law enforcement. She kind of gravitated towards law enforcement because of that family member. And she was a woman. I mean, so, you know, in a boys club, you know, and absolutely. I mean, when you look at her career, she was a female in a boys club. And, you know, she took it. I mean, they gave it to her. There's a lot of instances where, you know, she wasn't treated rightly because she was female. Absolutely. I agree with that. I agree with her there. It was hard. It was tough for her to get into that work and to be the person she wanted to be. So in that respect, I mean, she had a tough, difficult time being who she was in law enforcement.
Now, who was the victim to her? What was this relationship? Where did it begin for them?
So she met a guy. I mean, she knew this guy. Tracy used to work at a tanning salon. And there was a gym next door, I believe. And this guy would pull up in his Corvette. And this is, you know, the 90s. And he'd pull up in his Corvette and with his tank top on. And he'd be beefy. And, you know, he had kind of a mullet. And he'd pull up and he'd walk into the tanning salon and hit on her. And she just thought he was just full of ego and a muscle head and a steroid guy and didn't want anything to do with him. And he pursued her and pursued her and pursued her. And she went out with him one night. And she actually went home and said, I want nothing to do with that guy. She didn't trust him. He called her. He said he was going through a divorce, but she thought he was still married. And she just said, you know what? I don't ever want to see you again. And she didn't see him until about, I don't know, I think it was maybe a year and a half, 2 years later, she's in a restaurant and in walks the same guy. And they kind of exchanged looks and they exchanged numbers and they started dating. And in relationship, just, you know, he was a different guy at that time. She was a different person, different woman. And the relationship kind of took off from there and it kind of really went on a fast track and, you know, they fell in love and, they started working out together. She was a deputy, you know, he owned his own welding business. And he had these exotic birds that he was raising. And he was buying them and he was raising them and selling them, all legit. In fact, it's the birds that kind of begin this quest for the missing boyfriend because he first goes missing.
Well, how long were they a couple before this happens?
Probably about 8 months or so, I would say 7-8 months. It wasn't a long-term relationship. I mean, they were tight though. I mean, and what happened was if you believe the prosecution, the motivation behind this is that, you know, he wanted nothing to do with her anymore. And that's clear. That's clear that they were broken up. They were fighting. And Doug Benton, the victim, told Tracy Fortson, he said, look, I don't want you in my life anymore. Stay out of my life. And a couple of days later, he goes missing. That's what happens.
Now, was there any kind of background on him? Had he ever been investigated for abuse or abusive actions, anything that would start to red flag him as being, you know, somebody that might be looking for, you know, I don't put that the right way, but, you know, somebody that may have set himself up for being murdered out of protection or out of, you know, desperation?
I mean, no, yes and no. I mean, Doug Benton was this is well documented that he's a steroid user. So we could argue that there was some steroid rage there. And look, him and Tracy went at it a couple of times, and it wasn't like just a yelling match. I mean, guns were pulled, that sort of thing. Threats were made, that sort of thing. So when they fought, according to the stories, they fought. I mean, it wasn't necessarily violent, but it was heading towards that way, and it was a lot of threats going back and forth. So that was part of it. The other thing is that if we jump ahead a little bit and we start to go to my interviews with Tracy, she brings up this theory that Doug.
Well, hold on. Before we get into that, then let's. So we're not jumping in and out of timelines too much. So they were together 8-9 months. He wants out of this relationship. He basically ends it with her. A few days later, he goes missing. And when this happens, is there any suspicion immediately of where this guy has gone, what might have happened to him, or was he known to just kind of drift on time to time and take off?
No, I mean, he wasn't known as someone who would cough and disappear, but he lived alone. He had his own house, you know, extended trailer. He had his own place. He was his own guy. He's an adult. I mean, he came and go as he wanted to. But that's the thing. You ask a good question. He wasn't known as a guy who would disappear for a week or two. And that's what happens here. He ends up, he's gone. He's missing for 2 weeks. And finally, someone notices his birds are dead. No one's taking care of his birds. I mean, it was not the norm that Doug Benton should be missing. Let's just say we all have habits that we get stuck into in our lives,
right?
You know, the normal routine. And if you stop doing those things in your life, things begin to happen, right? So the weeds start to pile up on the side of the house, or, you know what I mean? Your car hasn't moved, or, you know what I'm saying? Or you haven't been down to the donut shop in 10 days and everyone's wondering where you are. You know, so there's habits we don't even know we do that once we're not doing them, they get noticed right away. And sure enough, that's what happened in this case. The neighbor just realized that Doug loved his birds. Not only that, but he had $30,000 invested in these birds, and there's no way he would let them die. You know, so something's wrong.
So it's a few weeks at this point that he's been missing. Once the alert is sounded then that, hey, I think something fishy is going on here, how long does it take before they find a body?
The body is found. Well, here's the thing. So the neighbor, and this is where I kind of launched the story in the book, which I think is a great launching point for this book, because what you have is the neighbor calling the cops and saying, hey, this guy's birds are dead. He's my neighbor. I see him all the time. I don't know where he is, but something's wrong. I just can feel it, you know? And while that's happening, this guy is on his farm. This guy who takes care of like 1,500 acres nearby. He's on his farm on an ATV driving around. And he's, you know, checking out his land, and he notices this horse trough, this kind of, you know, galvanized metal horse trough, 6 foot long, sticking out of the ground out on the farm. And he sees it. So he drives over to it, and he notices it's full of cement, and there's some topsoil poured over it. It's crudely painted like camouflage. And he stops and he says to himself, what the hell? Why is this here? This has no business being here. It's so full of cement that part of it's like kind of sunken into the ground, into the soil. So he calls the, you know, he calls the local sheriff and he says, you know, I got to get this thing out of here. I don't know what it's doing here, but you know, I got to get it out of here. So he goes back, he gets his, you know, his tractor, and the sheriff meets him out there. You know, the deputies, you know, a couple of cops meet him out there. It happens to be a Georgia Bureau of Investigation agent. It just happens to be at the sheriff's department at that time. So he goes out there, even they're out there. And while they're picking this thing up, bang, an arm pops out of it. They're chiseling away at it to see what it is. And bang, an arm kind of pops out. And on that arm is a tattoo. And one of the deputies says, I recognize that too. That's Doug Benton. That guy hangs around at the sheriff's department. That's Tracy Fortson's boyfriend. And so they pop his name in and they say, geez, that guy has been reported missing. He's been missing for 2 weeks. Well, yeah, he's been missing for 2 weeks because he's been sitting in this field inside this trough full of cement for the past 2 weeks. So that's how this whole story begins.
And once the body is discovered, how quickly does the spotlight swing to Tracy as a suspect?
Well, that's an interesting question. If you ask me, you'll get an answer. If you ask her, you'll get another answer. And if you ask the deputies, you'll get another answer. So that's where this book is a little bit different from the ones I generally write, because in this book, I become part of the story. And the reason I become part of the story is because I start interviewing Tracy about this, because she claims she's been framed, she's innocent, all that. I begin interviewing her, and we kind of spar. We get into this sparring match, because with me, Dave, you know my work, you know my career.
Right.
Someone tells me something like that, I'm going to push back on him and push back on him until I see some evidence. You can't tell me you've been framed. You can't tell me you've been innocent unless you show me some kind of proof. Because if I had a dollar for every murderer who told me that they were innocent, I would be paying for my dinner tonight when I go out to eat. You know, I'd have 50, 60 bucks in my pocket because they all do. Right. They all do. So, you know, I'm rolling my eyes and I'm like, Tracy, you know, the evidence here is just overwhelming. And it is, I should say, the evidence here in this case is overwhelming. The ducks just start lining up one after the next, after the next, after the next, that point to Tracy Fortson as the murderer. So then I got to ask myself, gee, is it too perfect? I've never seen a case so perfect. I've never seen a case where every piece of the puzzle is just bang, 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 bang. It's right there for him. So I kind of look at it in that all them different angles. And the reason I become part of the story is just because Tracy and I start to get into this whole back and forth. So I'm like, I have to include this in the book. It's the only way to tell this story is to include this in the book. So it becomes a first person narrative at that point. And I want evidence, man. I don't want your opinion. I don't want your opinion of the evidence. I don't want you telling me, oh, you got to find this piece of documentation because this will explain it all. No, I don't, because that doesn't exist. You know what I mean? So going back to your question, I believe law enforcement, they didn't target Tracy. I don't believe they targeted Tracy. I believe that they started to pick up on, they started to turn over the rocks, and under each rock was like a different direction that led to Tracy. So you look.
Right. So it wasn't a witch hunt. It wasn't like, oh, he's dead. You know, she was the girlfriend. It's automatically got to be her. They didn't go in with that predisposed idea. They started doing an actual investigation. And as they were kicking over these different clues, they all just pointed to Tracy. There was no ifs, ands, or buts about what they were finding evidentiary, right?
Well, the thing about this is whenever you investigate a murder, the first, you do a victimology. And if the murder victim is a stone that falls into a lake, the first ring, the first ripple is everybody that victim knew. And the first person on that list is always the spouse or the boyfriend or the girlfriend. That's the first person you go to get answers, not to accuse, but you got to go there with one eyebrow raised saying, huh, okay, were you two getting along? That's an honest question to ask, you know? And so when you start dragging in friends of the victim, and the friends of the victim begin to say, look, Tracy was volatile. Tracy was loud. Tracy degraded that guy. Tracy got in arguments with that guy. Tracy was controlling. Tracy didn't want that guy hanging around, me hanging around with that guy. And when that guy dumped her and broke up with her, boy, was she pissed. Okay, so now you got to pursue that. You have to. And that's what happened. When I look at all the reports here of the first questions asked of all the witnesses, I see that over and over again. I see them just nonchalantly ask, okay, tell me about Tracy Fortson, the girlfriend. Not, you know, accusatory, but tell me about her. And so when a piece of information comes in, oh, they got in a fight one day and she pulled out a gun. Oh, really? No kidding. Oh, yeah, I heard that Tracy, her last boyfriend, I heard Tracy tried to burn him alive while he was in his trailer.
What?
Oh, really? Yeah. So when you start hearing things like
right. that. Right. All of a sudden, she's starting to build a dossier of kind of weird activity.
And whether they're true or not is beside the point. If you're actively investigating a crime, you have to then start tracking all this stuff down. And through that is interviewing Tracy, right?
Exactly. So you're doing this. The police are invested in this because, again, all the evidence seems to be pointing her direction. And what you're finding from hearsay from the past is that she might have kind of a predilection to some weirdness and violence. So it's even starting to stack up more against her. When you go in to start to do your interview process with her and she's telling you she's been framed, what was the turn of the screw that made you start to look at, you know what, even though circumstantial, this looks like she's, you know, she's my gal, something's off on this.
Well, the off part on it for me was that it was so perfect. I mean, you know, they go to the house, they go to Tracy's house, there's a gun. The gun matches a bullet fragment taken out of Doug Benton's head. They go to her garage. There's remnants of cement just being mixed. Bags of cement are missing, but there's remnants of it. They look in her truck. There's a scrape along the bed of the truck where you could have pulled a horse trough out. There's cement all over the back of the truck, you know, fresh powder cement plus wet cement that had, you know, kind of spilled over and dried, right? Right. There's that. And then you go down, you start tracking down all the feed stores in town and you find a feed store in town. And he says, yep, Tracy Fortson was here 2 weeks ago and she bought a horse trough and she bought 10 bags of cement. You know, and you're like, you feel like you're being led to the slaughter here. Right. You feel like, you know, someone's just leaving you breadcrumbs.
Right.
I mean, come on. Right. 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 You begin to ask Tracy about a timeline and She certainly got time in her day to do all of this. You ask her what she did that day, and you find out she went to Walmart, and the body's wrapped in a shower curtain, and you find out she bought a brand new shower curtain at Walmart. She has the receipt in her house, they find.
But we look at a lot of these cases, Matthew, that, you know, when you start looking at them in the you know, armchair quarterback position, the next day, it's easier to see these pieces lining up and looking almost too perfect. But a lot of these criminals do make pretty stupid mistakes when they're going along, leaving receipts, you know, being caught on video purchasing these items. When you're saying that it just seemed too perfect, I guess I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around it. People make mistakes, but so you believe that there might have been more a conspiratorial angle to set her up to look like she was the one involved in this. Did she have any explanations for the receipts, the scrapes, or was it all, I don't know where it came from. I just don't know.
Oh, no, she had an explanation for it all. It's all outlined in the book. She had an explanation for it all. There's plenty more here.
Right.
You know, Tracy had left the department, the sheriff's department, right before this murder under some interesting circumstances where she wasn't doing a good job. They let her go. She filed an unemployment claim that the sheriff, Ray Sanders, was fighting her on that claim. So Tracy lashes out and files a sexual harassment suit against the department. So she's claiming motivation is she made the Roy Sanders look bad in the public eye because that sexual harassment suit becomes public. There's a newspaper article about it. And she claims this was all motivation behind him getting back at her. All right. So there's that working in the background. what she says is, yes, I did buy the horse trough because I have a horse. And she had a horse right down the street. She had a horse in a field that she fed and needed the horse trough for. Yes, I did buy the cement because I was building a dog pen in the back of my yard. She was building a dog pen in the back of your yard. No doubt about it. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And, well, how did he end up in the horse trough with the cement, you know, that you bought and all that? Well, here's the thing. I came home one day and I had bought the 10 bags of cement. I had bought that trough. And you know what? They were missing. Somebody stole them. That's what she says. Hmm. Somebody stole them. Now, you know, all right, let's look at all of that now. Well, I begin to look at that, and I begin to really sketch this out. And in order for this to be a conspiracy, in order for this to happen the way she says, we're talking about at least three agencies, major agencies, would have to have officers involved in this. They would have to be. You would have to know when she bought this stuff. So you would have to have somebody following her around, waiting for her to purchase something like this and say, aha, this is how we're going to do it. Right?
Right.
Because how do you know if you're setting her up to steal that stuff? How do you know to pick that day that she has all that stuff, to steal all that stuff and then set her up for it? Right? Or do you have people following her around? I mean, that's generally not how you frame somebody for a murder. You don't frame somebody for a murder by this elaborate thing of burying the guy in this horse trough and cement, and the cement's purchased by the, you know, like you said, Dave, most of the time, it is what it is.
Right.
Right? Murderers are not smart people. You know, I like to say it like this, Dave. Every murderer plans the murder up until the point of pulling the trigger, and they plan nothing afterwards, right? Nothing, you know. Whereas you get a professional murderer like a hitman, every single part of that is planned. That's why you rarely see a hitman in a court of law, because he's a professional and he plans every single part of it out. Whereas something like this, I mean, we haven't even talked about the second crime scene, and that's the crime scene in Doug's house, where you have Doug, who was murdered on his couch, stabbed in the stomach, okay? And then he's pulled out of his house, he's put into this horse trough, and the cement's poured, and then he's dumped in the field, okay? Now, so you have all this blood on the couch, you have all this stuff, right? So this they claim happens on, you know, let's say a Friday or whatever. Well, what you have then is you have cops now looking for him. Okay. 2 weeks later, you have cops roaming around his house looking for him, right? Right. The birds are dead. The cops go over there. He's a missing person now. So they go inside the house, right? They don't find anything. Well, 2 days later, they go back inside the house with a search warrant. You know what they find inside the house 2 days later? They find kerosene all over the place inside the house, all over the rug, and they find candles that had burned out. Someone went in there after they went in there the first time to burn that crime scene down. Who would have done that? She claims someone in law enforcement would have done that because they knew. Well, she was in law enforcement. She had plenty of people in law enforcement. She knew they were looking at her at that point, right?
But with that said, so, knowing that they're looking at you, would you be stupid enough to go to the crime scene? I mean, it's the old, you know, from all the old shows, I remember, Matthew, them saying, you know, that the criminal always returns to the scene of the crime. Would a police officer be that stupid to show back up?
Because there was so much forensic evidence they found. When that place did not burn down, they found all sorts of forensic evidence there.
Well, didn't they find the forensic evidence 2 days before? Shouldn't they have already collected that for their kids?
No, because he was a missing person at the time. So they go in as a missing person under suspicion of a missing person. They can go in without a warrant, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're in there looking around. The next day, he's found in that field. They don't have a body yet.
Right, but when they went through there the first time, didn't they find the blood on the couch?
No, didn't find any of that because it had all seeped through the couch, right? It like the cushions were turned over. It had all seeped through the couch. They didn't find any of that stuff. Nothing really looked out of place or anything. It had been kind of cleaned up, you know? And it wasn't until they ripped up the carpet and they found blood underneath the carpet, right? Because the place was then covered with kerosene at that point, the rug was. So he was a missing person when they went in there first time. Second time they go in there, he's a murder victim. There's an active crime scene, two active crime scenes. So there's, you know, yeah. And she was interviewed in between this, is what I'm saying, is Tracy Forson is interviewed in between these two instances, right?
Well, Matthew, is there anybody at this point, aside from Tracy, that would have anything to gain from Doug's death? Is there anybody that had life insurance policy out on him? Anything that would, you know, start to maybe cause an eyebrow to raise towards somebody else, maybe even Mom's direction?
No. But Tracy then brings this other argument to the table. Remember I mentioned earlier that we're talking about a CI. We're talking about Doug might have been a CI, confidential informant.
Right.
Right. Tracy claims maybe there was a conspiracy between the department to get rid of their confidential informant because he knew too much. He knew what was really going on. He found out what was really going on. And maybe the big dope dealer that he ended up turning in had him murdered and framed her. And every time I heard that there was evidence coming to show that he was a confidential informant, I never found it. I never got it. It never came. It never arrived. Every time I heard, oh, this person here can tell you what happened. This person here knows it was a setup. That person never came to me. That person never ended up telling me his story.
But is that a surprise? If you realize that maybe the law enforcement, the people that are there to protect us, really are involved in this, and they've already done this to one person and framed another law enforcement official, I wouldn't come forward. I'd be pretty hard-pressed to come forward for fear that I would be the next one in a trough in somebody's field.
Yeah. If you're going to go down that road, sure. Absolutely. But I can't go down that road without anything pointing me in that direction. You know what I mean?
Would you ask? I mean, and these people were just like, no, that didn't happen. Or would they just not return a call, not return an email?
Yeah. The sheriff, Ray Sanders, he would not talk to me. The GBI people, they wouldn't talk to me because I believe that they didn't know which angle I was coming from. You know, they knew I was talking to Tracy and they didn't know where I was coming from. But nonetheless, they should have talked to me. However, though, the documentation in this case is extensive. So I had a lot of access to and I did interview lots of people, but I had a lot of access to lots of documentation, which is my forte. That's what I like, because the documents don't lie, because, you know, people can lie. But, you know, you look at evidence in retrospect when you sit it all out in front of you. That stuff doesn't lie. That stuff rises to the surface. The truth, you know, the truth generally rises to the surface. You know, there was a problem with the ballistics expert in this case. Tracy banged on and on and on about how can they tell that bullet came from my gun because the bullet was mushroomed. Well, yes, the bullet was mushroomed. And she says, and I believe the ballistics expert they used, Bernadette Davy, you know, she lied. I believe she lied on the stand. And I did some research and I found that actually Bernadette Davy ended up being fired years after Tracy's case for lying and falsifying police reports, ballistics reports. But Dave, you say, ooh, and I said, ooh, but you know what? When you look deep into that, when you look deep into the mistakes that she made falsifying reports, it was out of laziness. It wasn't out of nefarious purposes. There was nothing nefarious about what she did. Nothing.
Well,
it was all out of laziness.
But Matthew, isn't that nefarious when you're if you're saying, okay, Dave, you're kind of lazy, but your laziness just got me in prison for the rest of my life and maybe death penalty if that's the state they're in. That seems to me to beg the idea that there is a nefarious nature aside from just being dumb and lazy at your job when you are now putting other people's lives in jeopardy for a crime they may not have committed. That seems like there's some. You know, there's some dark issue going on with that person right there, because they don't have any kind of respect for human life if that's what they're willing to do in order to just get their job done.
Well, you know, we're talking about this in very short terms. I outline it all in the book.
Right. I understand.
Finding these documents. And what I mean by laziness is maybe short-sighted is what I mean by that is there's no doubt the testing that this woman did in Tracy's case is accurate. There's just no doubt. It's science. Science doesn't lie. That bullet, mushroomed or not, came from Tracy's gun. That was proven in a court of law. There's no doubt in my mind that that's a fact. Okay. Later on, she's fired over, you know, on a report saying, you know, okay, I did five test firings of this one weapon, and she only pulled the trigger four times instead of five. Something sidetracked her, and she lied on the report and said, I did it five, because that's what you're supposed to do by the book. Supposed to do five, I did five, but in reality, she only did four. Things like that. It's not like she was lying on the witness stand about
right.
things and of that nature, and that's a different thing. I can't negate what she did in Tracy's case based on that. You know, I have to look at the science there in Tracy's case. I have to look at the science, and I believe the science in the case. Other arguments Tracy would make just didn't make. And like, she made a claim that the medical examiner lied on a report saying that he is the one who did the autopsy on Doug Benton. And I tried to explain to her that the medical examiner's only problem in his report was grammar. He didn't know where to put a comma.
Okay.
And she read that as he did the autopsy, not the establishment, right? Not the establishment. The medical examiner's office did the autopsy, right? So underneath his banner, the medical examiner has a lot of coroners who work for him. He's the medical examiner. He has a lot of doctors who work for him. You know, and I said to Tracy, I said, do you believe that the medical examiner, the chief medical examiner, would lie on a report that he did an autopsy on a guy? Do you believe that? When it could easily be proven that he didn't. You know what I mean?
Well,
that just makes that argument doesn't make any sense.
Well, we've heard from Tracy's perspective, you know, she's throwing out all of these possibilities and conspiracies. What was the police's perspective on this? Why did they believe, and what was the motive that they tried to pin on Tracy for killing Doug?
Well, here's the great thing about law enforcement and detective work. They don't have to believe anything but the evidence. They don't have to have a theory. They don't have to have a motive. They don't have to have anything but evidence. And that's what they did in this case. They followed the evidence. Why? But I'll answer your question. Why did they believe that she killed Doug? Because she was a volatile powder keg. And when someone told her, I don't want you no more, it turns into one of the classic storylines. If I can't have you, nobody will, Doug. You do not leave me. Look, there's no doubt about it. Tracy was an explosive person, and she definitely manhandled Doug. Doug was a big guy, but they fought. And when they fought, you know, guns came out. Guns were stuck in people's faces, that sort of thing. So when Doug, the final straw was, I don't want you no more. You stay out of my life. Don't ever come back in my life. You know, we have that classic story was, I can't have you, nobody will. And you know what? I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you for everything you've done to me. We see it time and again. It happens all the time.
Now, talk to me about the fact, when you started working on this, you believed that she was 100% guilty. But the more you got to know her, the more you began to question that guilty verdict. But it still sounds like you're still on the side of science is proving she's the guilty party in this. Where do you stand on this case, Matthew?
Well, where I stand on this case is very simple. If I put myself in the juror's position, and if I'm a juror on this case, I have to vote guilty, because there's nothing during her two trials that she got a second trial. The appeals court gave her a second. If I'm on the jury for each one of those trials, I have to vote guilty. There's no other alternative. I can, whether I believe she did it or not, I think is beside the point. The evidence tells me that she is the guilty person. She is the guilty person. There's nothing else that tells me she's not. There's nothing. And if I'm in a court of law, that's what I have to do, you know? So until the day I see the evidence that shows me, tells me, proves to me that she was framed, I just have to continue to believe that she committed this murder. You know, I have to.
So what got her the first appeal? If the case was this cut and dry, usually to get an appeal, there has to have been mistakes made or something that was overlooked in the first case. What was it that they were willing to reexamine for the second case?
I believe in the first trial, you know, incompetence by the lawyer, that sort of thing, her defense lawyer, some loophole there. They granted her a second trial based on that. And also, I believe some new evidence she claimed that she had dredged up. And they gave her her day in court for that new evidence, and it didn't amount to nothing. What that new evidence was her daughter, Tracy's daughter, claimed that she recorded somebody on the phone, one of Doug Benton's best friends, admitting on the phone that it was a setup, the cops were involved, etc. And she has those tapes, etc. I've never heard them. I asked for them repeatedly. I never heard them. But Tracy writes out this 18-page affidavit about these tapes. And ultimately, the guy didn't know he was being recorded. Secondly, when asked, the guy would not sign an affidavit agreeing to his statement. He would not go into a court of law and testify to the fact that they were claiming. So what good is that information? To me, that's information discussed at bar now. That's nothing. It's nothing. You know, it doesn't add up to anything. I tried to contact the guy wouldn't talk to me, you know? So does he hold the key to all of this? Maybe he does, but he's not willing to go on record or sign an affidavit to that fact. So right now it's meaningless.
Why?
It's meaningless.
Matthew, do you understand why in some states it's illegal to record somebody without their knowledge? And like, I'm in the state of Minnesota. I can record yours and my phone call, okay, and I never have to let you know.
Yeah, you can do that here in Connecticut too.
Right. So why is that law?
I'm recording you right now, Dave.
Oh God. Now I'm gonna take back everything I was gonna say. But no, seriously. I mean, why is it admissible in some states and not in others? That seems like a pretty big inconsistency in law. Do you know anything about that by any chance?
Yeah, I've done a lot of research on that because I've recorded some pretty famous people talking BS to me on the phone with their lawyers. I mean, it's just the way that state wants to carry on its business of privacy. And it's up to the states to do that. It's not, you know, federal. But on the other hand, I mean, we could discuss, debate this all day of whether it's right or wrong. But in the end, what we're saying in this case is that tape then allowed into court?
Right.
And the answer is no. It's not, unless you can prove that it's that guy on the phone. How do we know that it's the guy that she said on the phone? How do we know that whole call wasn't set up with some actor that they got? How do we know that? Well, we know that if the guy that she says it is willing to sign an affidavit and then go into court and raise his hand and say, that is me on that tape, and I said those words, and I stand by them right now. In fact, the same guy testified in both trials and mentioned nothing about what she says that he said on those tapes.
One more kind of rabbit hole on this aspect of it, and then we'll get back in to wrap up. But I'm just curious. So if I record a conversation with you and you admit to me, yeah, Dave, I love this stuff, I'm so fascinated by it because I've been killing people for years, and I take that in, and in my state it's illegal to do that. But if you and I were in a McDonald's lobby talking about this and I'm recording you, I can't use mine. But if the overhead video camera picks up you saying this to me, would that be something that would be admissible in court? Do you know?
I'm not sure about that. That's probably a good, again, that's a Big Brother privacy thing. I don't know. I don't know, Dave. I wish I could answer that question. You know, we can't just be dragging anybody into court over stuff they say like that, because people talk BS all day long, you know. So We can't just...
Right. I was just wondering if there was a defining line between what is... Because in that case, you and I might not even realize we're both being recorded. But if we're in a public place that says that there are security cameras, we are being recorded while in there. Do we give up that right then to our privacy by having that conversation recorded? Or if the girl sitting in the booth behind us is running her phone and she's talking to a friend and leaving a voicemail and they happen to hear you saying this, it's caught in the background, the girl talking didn't even notice it because she was busy talking. That's why the whole recording aspect is so dodgy to me. But like you said, then we have to prove that voice is Matthew on the line, that it's not just somebody that sounds remarkably like him, but it's actually him. And then will he go on the stand and admit to what he just said? So I get that aspect. I was just curious if you knew in some of these little rabbit circles, if we were, what was admissible and what was not. So she's run out of appeals at this point, correct? Unless something major opens up for her, like this guy steps forward or some other piece of evidence that gets, turned over eventually. Is she out of luck now? Is she done?
Yeah, all her appeals are exhausted now. I think earlier this year, her last one was denied. And rightly so. I mean, she's had 2 shots. She produced this affidavit that was argued in court and thrown out. What's left? Really, what's left? I mean, if she's been framed, then I feel really bad. I feel really bad, but there's nothing that tells me that that's a fact. I mean, everything else tells me that she did it, motive, opportunity, all the evidence, the forensics, none of that stuff says she didn't do it. All of it says she did do it, it's a difficult case. That's what makes it interesting for me from this perspective as an investigative journalist and a writer, is that there's a lot of, meat and potatoes in there to look at. And you have a person like Tracy who, as I detail in the last maybe 100 pages of the book, 80 pages of the book, she just goes up and down one side of me. She really bashes the hell out of me until I put her in her place and say, listen, this isn't about me. It's about the truth. That's what I'm after.
I'm just curious. I'm curious, Matthew, if you were digging into this and her story started to pan out and there was some kind of conspiracy involved, would you still press forward to release a book like this showing that you believe there was a conspiracy, knowing that if they were willing to kill before, what's going to stop them from wiping you out and making it look like an accident? Or would you just press forward?
Oh, 100%. I would press forward. I'd publish the book. 100%. I was hoping to find something. Hoping to find something, I mean, you can, in the beginning, in my author's note, you can kind of see the kind of different feelings I have throughout this whole thing. At first I don't believe anything she says, and then I start to believe her, and then I start to say, wait a minute, this is not adding up. And then I start to see that every argument she makes is really based in opinion. It's not based in fact, and I try to make that point to her. What you're telling me is your opinion about this evidence. It's not a fact about this evidence. You got to get that straight. And that's when she says, I'm done talking to you. And she cuts me off. We don't speak for like 3 months.
And was she forthcoming from your first request to talk about this case, or was she, reticent to do that? And possibly, especially being in law enforcement, you got to be careful with who you talk to and what you're willing to come forth with. How long did it take you before you were able to actually get her to agree to meet and talk?
It wasn't hard. It was an email. I emailed her. Most of my interviews I did with her, I did through email, which is great because it's all, it's all documented.
Right.
I'd ask her a question and she'd bang on for 10 pages about the question, she was more than willing to talk. That's for sure. And she sent me an email recently that says, I owe you an apology. I misjudged you completely. You are definitely a man of your word. It's an excellent piece of work. Thank you for giving me a voice. Cause I told her in the beginning, I said, listen, I can make you one promise, and the promise is that I will give you a voice, but I'm also going to, tell the side of the prosecution. I'm going to talk about the truth. I'm going to talk about the I'm going to talk about everything, but I will give you your voice. I will not censor your voice. And I definitely allowed her a voice.
Well, now that that book is out, what's next for you?
I am working on a book about a case near you, actually, in upper peninsula of Michigan, up there in Fargo country, basically. And it's a very interesting case. Kelly Cochran, she had a lover, and her husband murdered the lover, and then her husband winds up dead. And it's a very interesting case. So I'm working on a book about that right now, and I have about 5 television projects that I'm involved in on different levels, in front of the camera and back of the camera, executive producing, etc.
Well, please keep us in mind when you release a new book, when you've got new projects. We'd love to have you visit with us again. And I've got one off-topic question, if you'd be interested in throwing this out. It's a fascinating question posed to me by one of our listeners. She says, my niece wants to know, if she donates her hair to Locks of Love and the recipient of her hair were to commit a crime and left hair at the crime scene, will the niece's DNA be found all over the crime scene and thus incriminate her? She's 12 years old.
Wow. What a question.
Now, my only thought I think when they cut the hair, they cut it, you know, they're not taking it from the root. And isn't the only way to get the DNA is if they've got root samples?
Well, today, I mean, today you can find out a lot from a piece of hair. So, I mean, to get actual DNA, you need the root, I believe, from what I've been told,
right,
from my experience. But I'm no scientist, but yeah, you could still find out a lot about someone from a piece of hair. But that's an excellent, I mean, you know, I think that's a good avenue to explore in fiction. You know, that'd be great to explore in fiction.
Certainly actually would, especially when you think of some of these people that are getting transplants as well.
Yeah.
If that DNA is mixed and you're able to pull DNA from kidney, liver, something like that, or even the heart that's pumping it through, and they cut themselves at a crime scene, would their DNA be a part of the mix now? That'd be interesting. What a weird twist, huh? Make you rethink everything you're doing when you're being kind. I hope that doesn't stop people in their tracks, but that would certainly be a holy what-if moment, huh?
It certainly would. That's a great question,
Matt,
viewer, listener.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure catching up with you. I love our chats, and thanks for being open to taking different questions and going in different avenues. Much success in the future. We'll be watching for you on TV and with your new books as well. All right, guys, stay tuned. Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals, we've got them. Tim, are you ready to dip into the bag of stupidity this week? Our first story comes out of St. Louis, Tim. Believe it or not, St. Louis. And this one's actually a little bit darker.
Not Florida?
No, this is a little darker than we normally read about, but I was intrigued by the headline on this. St. Louis pizza delivery driver kills a robber during a shootout.
Huh.
Boy, pizza delivery guys are tough as nails in St. Louis. And Imo's pizza delivery driver shot and killed a man who tried to rob him in South St. Louis Thursday night. Police say they were called to the 4600 block of Spring at around 11:30 p.m. for a report of a shooting. The victim, 41-year-old Caucasian man, tells police that he was in the process of delivering food when two men attempted to rob him. One of the suspects struck the man in the back or in the head with a firearm. The same suspect started to fire shots at him when he ran back in his vehicle. The delivery driver returned fire with his own handgun and was not hit during the gunfight. The second robber left the scene on foot. The pizza delivery driver was able to return to work after the attempted robbery. That's where he called police. He's suffering from a cut to his head. Jesus, I'd quit my job. He's like, I gotta get back. There's more pizzas to deliver. This guy's crazy. The St. Louis, and I don't mean that in a bad way, Post-Dispatch reports that the suspect's body was found near Spring and Taft Avenues. The pizza delivery driver turned his gun over to police so they can further investigate the incident. The only description police give of the robbers is that they are African-American males. Police are still searching for the second suspect. Police believe the shooting was justified and the death of the robber does not count towards the city's total homicides. The city stands at 191 homicides for the year. Justified cases include self-defense and fatal police shootings. Man, note to self, do not screw with St. Louis pizza guys.
Or at least order pizza.
Yeah, right. You know how we did the story last, was a week or two ago, right? About how the The guy tried to break into a car that had waiting deputies in it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, there seems to be a rash of this kind of going on, breaking into just really dumb places. We're going to go to Columbus, Georgia. Are you ready? A local family has had an unusual mess to clean up after burglars ransacked their home Thursday afternoon. The Burnhams are missing more than their personal belongings. They're missing half their bathroom floor. Locked doors didn't stop these burglars, who decided to avoid the home's security cameras by coming through the crawl space. Timothy Burnham tells News 3's Michaela Singleton. He came home around 5 p.m. to find an enormous hole in his floor of his bathroom, as well as his entire safe full of guns were missing. My cabinet, gun cabinet was right here, and it had close to $80,000 worth of firearms, Burnham says. Rifles, handguns, collectible pieces, and hundreds of rounds of ammo, all in the burglars' hands. That might be the scariest news story I've ever read, Tim.
Yeah.
Holy crap. Burnham says his family hasn't gone through all the damage to the house yet, but they did notice jewelry missing, family heirlooms, and his daughter's new Christmas presents. Adding to that, Burnham says the burglars also caused thousands of dollars worth of damage where they broke in underneath the home. They destroyed my plumbing, all my water lines. I don't have any water in my house now, he says. I can't use the toilets or showers. It's awful. Burnham says the damage puts an enormous weight on him, his wife, and two children. My wife's a full-time teacher and does after-school programs. My daughters have school. I'm a superior over at Fort Benning. I leave there and go to school till around 10 o'clock at night. Plus, I work side jobs to make ends meet. I barely have time for my family. I sure don't have time to be fixing all this, he says. The Columbus Police Department says the investigation into the burglary is going on. Now, for our listeners, if you believe you know anything about this burglary, please call 706-653-3400. That is 706-653-3400. If you know anything about this, they stole $80,000 worth of firearms and hundreds of rounds of ammo. Guys, turn this person in. Get him off the streets or people. Ugh. All right, here you go. Here's my luck. This is what it would be like for me if I was a criminal on the run, Tim. This is exactly what would end up happening to me. We're going to Hazard, Kentucky, Tim. While deputies cuckoo at the Perry County, Tennessee Sheriff's Office were out to lunch Monday afternoon, they noticed something that turned a lunch break into deputies making an arrest. We finally slowed down enough to eat lunch and several other of the guys, and while we were eating, we noticed a known fugitive that we've actually been looking for, said Tony Eversole, the Perry County Sheriff's Office Chief Deputy. Eversole said Neil Martin was eating lunch at the Captain D's in Hazard, Kentucky, right across from him. He said that Martin is wanted in multiple states for fraudulent business reasons. We've been looking for him for several months, said Eversole. He's wanted by four or five states, Eversole said, that they did not know how Martin would react, so they let him finish his meal and waited for him to leave the building. We let him eat so we wouldn't cause any trouble inside the restaurant, and then we got up as he left and followed him outside and made an arrest in the parking lot, said Eversole. Deputies say that although it was a serious situation, they made a little light of it after the arrest. We wanted to know if he was going to order his dessert to go, said Eversole. Martin is being held in the Kentucky River Regional Jail.
Do you really want to open your mouth around a place named Captain D's?
No. Good God. All right. You got to love this, right? So imagine you're out there. You're car thieving, Tim. You're breaking into cars. You're looking for sunglasses and loose change, maybe some Chiclets, a DVD, a CD, whatever might be in the car, right? And then you break into a car with two deputies. God, you've got to be the stupidest human on planet Earth, right?
Uh-huh.
No, I've got one that's better because I have five people arrested trying to break into a home while police were inside investigating it, Tim.
Oh, God.
We're going to Charlotte, North Carolina. Five people were arrested Friday night after trying to break into an uptown Charlotte townhouse twice. But the second time, police were inside investigating the first break-in. Friday evening, a man reportedly came home to find people inside his townhouse on Garden District Drive in the middle of a burglary. He was able to back out of his home without them noticing he was there, and he called 911, according to officers. I can just imagine him walking in there, not noticing that I'd been a much different situation, said Catherine Rowland, a neighbor concerned after the break-in. Charlotte Mecklenburg police arrived while the two were still in the house and arrested them. Police identified the two as 33-year-old Johnny Penny and 24-year-old Javanette Cathcart. Without knowing that the police were still inside the townhouse investigating the break-in, three more people returned to try to break into the home about 2 hours later. Officers said the three men tried to run away, but they were quickly apprehended. Malik Long, 20, Khalil Wallace, 22, and Jamaka Colbreth, age 16, are facing charges in the second attempted break-in. Boy, they picked the right house to be in that night. Penny and Cathcart both face felony breaking and entering and attempted larceny charges. Long also faces felony breaking and entering charges, as well as possession of stolen goods charges. Colbreth was charged with possession of stolen goods. Wallace was charged with breaking and entering, possession of stolen goods, larceny of a firearm, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, and possession of marijuana, Tim. After hearing about this, neighbors say they're now going to be extra alert. You hear stuff like this, and you have to be more precautious, even in a nice neighborhood like this, said Johnny Johnson, who also lives near the house where the break-in happened. The homeowner was not hurt. And this was a case, Tim, of swift justice. Swift justice. Swift justice. That is truly swift justice. Not only did it's like the cops won the dumb criminal lottery that night. They find the two criminals still in the house. Then three more morons try to get in, Tim, and they get arrested. You get five criminals for the price of two. Doesn't it make you wonder what this guy's got in his house that five different people knew that they wanted to break in there?
Yeah, I do want to know what was in there why do you take that chance?
Swift justice, swift justice, swift justice. That's what it was, Tim, swift justice.
I guess.
So if you're in Anchorage, Tim, and it's broad daylight and you're bored and you want to steal something, what could be about the dumbest thing you could steal in Anchorage in broad daylight?
A boat?
Well, it's an okay idea. I think I've got something a little bit dumber for you, though. An Alaska woman. Notice how I'm avoiding Florida as much as I can here. An Alaska woman came home to discover a thief broke into her home and stole clothing, jewelry, prescription drugs, and a zebra head she had on the wall. A security camera recorded a woman carrying items, including the zebra, out the front door of Stacy Scott's Anchorage, Alaska home last Friday and into a waiting cab. Being so brazen to come into someone's home, make yourself comfortable, and literally leave by calling a cab and putting a zebra in the back, Scott said to KTVA. Scott told the Anchorage television station that she received the zebra head from a friend when she worked at a downtown boutique. I thought it'd be a great addition to my home, just something fun and whimsical. I was about to dress him up for Christmas, actually, she said. Yeah, because, Tim, is there anything more fun and whimsical than a poor animal whose head has been chopped off and is hanging on your wall? Man, when I think of good times, I think of how many times I've almost cut your head off just to hang it on my wall in a moment of whimsy, Tim.
Huh?
What? I thought he'd be a great addition to my home, she said. She named him George. And she said he was a staple in her house. Oh, police arrested a 38-year-old woman named Desiree Fuller at an Anchorage motel where the cab driver dropped her off. The suspect is charged with felony burglary and theft. If a suspect leaves in a vehicle, we're going to do everything we can to track that down, said APD spokesman Renee Oysted. In the case of People Mover Bus, a cab company, when we call dispatches of those companies and find out where they pick people up, where they drop them off, police have recovered some of Scott's items, but George is still missing. He's on the run, Tim. The zebra head's on the run.
With what?
Scott is in disbelief that such an incident could occur in a busy neighborhood in broad daylight. She said, it's not about George and my stuff. It's just the brazenness of the whole thing. It's the holidays and people are giving. I certainly would have helped out in some way. You didn't have to do what you did. Bring back George. So if you know where George, the bodiless zebra is, please, please bring him back. George, we love you, George. We're waiting for you. Call us. Tesla's aren't easy to steal. But thieves in Utah allegedly made off with three $80,000 models by breaking into a dealership and stealing the fobs. After that, however, their master plan fell comically apart. One guy claimed a family member had died and left them all his stuff, but two of them actually said it was given to them by a man named Tesla. South Lake Police Detective Gary Keller told Fox 13, investigating a break-in at the dealership, police tracked down a suspect in one of the stolen Teslas and found him to be in possession of the keys, the dealership's business license, and a check for $49,500 made out to Tesla. In a burst of what may have been alcohol-fueled inspiration, he claimed his name was Tesla. And that someone he barely knew gave him the car and the keys. While police checked clues at the dealership, a stolen Tesla happened to drive right by them. It ran out of battery power a moment later, so police easily picked up the 27-year-old suspect, who apparently forgot about the whole never return to the scene of a crime thing. Later in the morning, the third stolen vehicle was found parked outside, wait for it, a liquor store, Tim. The latter two individuals said that they were part of the Tesla family, and the woman said she received the high-priced vehicle from Mr. Tesla himself, Tim. Luckily, the cars were undamaged and the doors not pried, likely because the thieves had the keys to get in. After getting lucky with the initial theft, it's pretty clear they weren't criminal masterminds, though. It's one of those cases where you're going, what? And you're scratching your head, Keller told KSL.com. The good thing is we have four people in custody and hopefully all the property has been returned. No. This is given to me. My name is Tesla. And a guy by the name of Tesla gave me this car, Tim. It's true. Look it up. It's factual. All right. Oh, my gosh. Where do I go with this? No, I'm going to keep that one for a little later. So talking about cars, let's go with this one, Tim. Right? This girl needs the theme Bad to the Bone attached to her. Are you ready for this? An 8-year-old Indiana girl could be facing charges after she stole her mother's car and led police on a cross-country chase Friday, according to reports. The unnamed girl was shopping with her mother when she allegedly stole the vehicle, Anderson Police Department spokesman Joel Sandifer told the Herald Bulletin. Well, who could blame her? She doesn't have a name, Tim. She's an unnamed girl. She's confused. She doesn't have a name. Police found her driving down a state road at speeds of up to 40 miles per hour. The girl, does that sound up to speeds of 40 miles per hour, Tim? Whoo, she's really burning rubber. The girl refused to stop until police boxed her in. She eventually tried to park her car and hit a police department cruiser while doing so, causing minor damage. Once the vehicle was fully stopped, the girl refused to come out. Police had to break the window and pull her out. The 8-year-old was taken into custody, and it's not clear if she or her mother will face charges. Well, they better, Tim, because that sounds like a case that's in desperate need of swift justice, swift justice, swift justice.
You better be careful because you're going to wear out our budget for this whole show.
Well, it's been a couple of weeks, Tim, and we haven't really had. I guess we had a couple last week that we missed out on, and people were very upset that we did not claim swift justice on them.
Oh, well, I'm sorry about that.
All right, since we're still on the road, Tim, let's go to Maryland, shall we?
Okay.
A 24-year-old woman said that a man tried to run her over after a minor car crash in Charles County, forcing her to jump onto the hood of his car and hold on as she drove down a Waldorf highway. Apparently, she's watched too many episodes of T.J. Hooker. Andre Thomas Crew, 27, of Waldorf, now faces felony assault and reckless endangerment charges, Maryland State Police said. Maryland State Police said Crew sideswiped the woman's car shortly before 10:45 p.m. on U.S. 301 at Mattawamon Drive in Waldorf. When the woman got out of her car to take a picture of Crew's vehicle tags, he accelerated to try to pin her between the two cars, police said. Police said the woman jumped onto the hood of the man's car to avoid being rammed and held on as he drove a quarter of a mile down the highway. The woman told police Crew supposedly tried to strike another vehicle to throw her off the hood, but she was able to jump off before he struck the other vehicle near Cedarville Road. Crew is being held at the Charles County Detention Center pending a bond review. He was charged with first-degree assault, second-degree assault, reckless endangerment, and other traffic offenses. Police and Crew said the woman did not know each other and the attack was random. Tim, I need to know, why was she only charged with assault? Why wouldn't it have been attempted homicide? She was trying to hit this woman with her car and then tried to ram into another car to throw her from the car. This sounds like attempted homicide to me.
Well, maybe she had the love of Jesus in her heart, Dave, and that's what kept her from being homicidal.
She's got the love, love, love down in her heart. Where? All right.
Down in her heart.
Where?
Down in her heart, Dave.
Oh, she's got the love of Jesus down in her heart. All right. Boy, I don't even know which one I want to go with here. Should we go to south of the border, Toronto, Canada, Tim? Or should we go out east, southern easternly? Is that a thing, southern easternly?
Yes.
And talk about Key West. Florida? Should we end on a Florida story? Let's end on a Florida story.
Yeah, end on a Florida
story. Let's go south of the border, Tim.
All right.
Right near the Texas borderline of Canada.
All right.
The Santa Claus at the Dunfermline Mall in Toronto was faced with a much larger dilemma than an ornery child this week. Instead, an adult woman challenged Santa's very identity. "You don't have a sleigh! No, you fucking dickhead!" she screamed as she called for security to remove the seemingly fake Santa. "You're not even real! I heard about it when I was a young kid!" The security guards eventually end up speaking with the woman, going on a profanity-laced argument against Santa Claus, or perhaps his stand-in replacement. "You're not magic! You're not real! You're not shit!" she continues. In response to the woman, Santa can be seen sitting on a large crimson couch as he continues to stare at the woman in disbelief. Her tirade continues as onlookers stand in the background, which features the front of a Walmart store. According to the Wall's Facebook page, the shopping center held a Silent Santa event on Sunday in which families with a child with autism were encouraged to visit Santa before mall hours without the distraction of large crowds, mall music, and holiday lights. It is unclear whether the video took place on Sunday, though it first appeared on social media this weekend. Should I try to see if I can play the audio from this?
Yeah, please.
I don't know how good it'll be. I'm literally going to play it. Let's see what we've got here. Hold on.
Okay.
That's some pent-up youthful rage right there.
That kid had his or her Denzel Training Day moment. That King Kong ain't got shit on me moment. You know that moment from the movie?
So you're seeing Denzel. What I'm hearing is a little Samuel L. "I'm tired of these motherfucking mall Santas in these motherfucking malls." Oh, pardon me. The language is out of control today.
I know.
Oh, that's bad. "Do you have a sleigh? No, you fucking dickhead." That's what she screams at him. "You ain't fucking magic." That is genius. We should have gone out on that one. We should have gone out on that one. Let's go to Florida just to wrap up, where a woman was allegedly caught urinating outside a Key West business on Thanksgiving and told officers, "I'm drunk and I'm pissed off," authorities said. Sophia Rose Wunsch, 46, was charged with disturbing the peace after her arrest on Duval Street. Monroe County jail records show a passerby called police after spotting Wunsch drunk driving Thanksgiving morning, according to an incident report obtained by the Florida Keys News. Officers arrived and found Wunsch squatting in some bushes near the driveway of a scooter rental business. "In plain view of the public," the report said. "I'm drunk and I'm pissed off," Wunsch told officers. According to the report, Wunsch was booked into jail and later released, much like her bladder, in front of the scooter store.
At least she was pissed off and not pissed on.
There oh, my go. God. That is great. Oh, thank you, dumb crimes and stupid criminals. We love you. You make our lives a little bit better. You know, we're going to do some... I knew a murderer this week, Tim, but I really kind of just want to go out on a happy note. So why don't we do an I Knew a Murderer next week on the show? And if you knew a murderer, I'm not talking about some motherfucking mall Santa lying to you asses. I mean, if you know a real murderer and you want to share your story, email us, dave@darknessradio.com, and we may read it on an upcoming episode. Be safe, be kind, love one another, for God's sakes. If you're pissed off at Mall Santa, stay away. Tim, are you choked up by the story? What's going on?
Yeah, I'm If I would have said that to Santa as a kid, I would have ended up with reindeer antlers up my ass.
I could still arrange that. I know a guy. But they might be tied to George the Zebra's head. I hope you don't mind. All right, guys. Have a good week. We'll be back next week with more of the best in True Crime Talk Radio. This is True Crime Tuesday.